This time on the show, standing out in a sea of diamond.
I get lots of girls and I hit people.
And I've got a Rube Goldberg machine for making comics. All this and more on Comics Are Great. It's Comics Are Great, the visual storytelling show, recorded live every other Wednesday at the Ann Arbor District Library in lovely downtown Ann Arbor, Michigan, comics.aadl.org. And this is the show where we talk about making comics, writing, drawing, character design, all of the struggles and lifestyle that comes with this medium that drives us all mad. My name is Jersey Drost, cartoonist and teaching artist, and with me today, we got a full house again. We got an in-studio guest. Dave Carter has returned to the show.
Hey, Jersey. I'm Dave Carter. I'm a comics librarian and video game archivist for the University of Michigan Library.
At the Duderstadt.
Duderstadt Center on North Campus. Beautiful North Campus.
Beautiful. It is very lovely up there, actually. Yeah, yes. It's very hilly and pretty and full of
and less wooded construction.
That's true. Downtown Ann Arbor right now is not quite so lovely because, yes, as soon as the sun comes out. Yes,
the lovely shades of orange start going up all over the place.
Everything falls apart and all the Lego guys come out to start building things back up again. But, yes, we should say the video game library is a library, and for those who are new to the show, because you've been on before to talk about this, it's a library of video game systems and games.
Yeah, so we've got we've got more than 5,000 games. We got more than 60 different systems. My audio just went out.
Suddenly, Dave went silent. You're being censored. AADL doesn't want people to know about the video game library.
So our latest acquisition, we got a Super Famicom from Japan.
Wow.
So I started to order a bunch of Super Famicom games released only in Japan. So if you can read Japanese.
So the original Super Mario 2.
I don't know if I've gotten that one yet or not, but I'll see what I can do about that. I can tell you're chomping at the bit. You should introduce your
special guest. Yes, I know. I want to make sure that people know why is the video game guy on here? You're also the comic book librarian.
Yes, I also select comics for the library.
Yes, so okay. And on the Skypes, first time on the show, and I can't believe it's been, this is the first time we've had you on, Jamie Gamble. Of MonkeyPipeStudios.com. Yeah. Gosh, how long have we known each other? Probably going on 4 years now?
I think it goes back like 3 or 4 years, yeah.
Going back to the days of the Art and Story podcast.
Yeah.
All those golden old days. But, okay, so you are a writer.
And I am, yes. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I write a series of comics, superhero comics, for a imprint called Monkey Pipe Studios. It's a micro publisher. It's something I do that I am trying to extend into online and create more digital presence and extend the universe, create a universe of superhero comics. And so far, it's okay.
We should talk about some of the books that we can find on there. So if people go to monkeypipestudios.com right now.
Monkeypipestudios.com, you'll see. I have some other books that were, they're kind of under the umbrella. They're people that I've collaborated with and worked with in the past, and I've given them space on the site to promote their own books. So there's a collection of books that don't build into the world that I've got. But the main ones I do are Department O, Hero Code, and The Black Wraith. And there's also an old book called Omniterium, which was the first book that I put out to self-publisher, and that's kind of hanging around still.
Actually, I think I did a pinup for Omniterium years ago, and there's a video on my YouTube page of like the process of drawing that piece. That was a great book, and I mean, all these books are great. Let's talk about some of the specific ones, like the Hero Code, which you write, and Jonathan Rector draws it. Now, Jonathan Rector, for those, he's been mentioned on the show a bunch of times, and I've actually talked about the Hero Code on the show before. It was one of my picks for the reading recommendation section. Jonathan Rector, the energy that this guy puts into his pages is just insane.
Yeah. I worry about him. I think he's he uses up a lot of energy. His artwork. He did the first issue. Sadly, he couldn't continue. He got kind of caught out with real life and other commitments. So that was one of the reasons I did the Black Wraith, was because we were trying to make it work. We were trying to hold out for as long as we could, and I put out a standalone story and a couple of other issues of other stuff, whilst I was waiting to see if he could empty his other commitments, he was working on a book called The Standard, put out by Comics Tribe, which is just finishing off 6-issue miniseries. And his day job, I think he shifted. He was doing work in retail, I believe, and then he got a job designing video game characters. And
oh, wow.
Yeah, so I think he went from having art as a relaxation after their work to doing art at work and then coming home and being faced with the prospect of doing pages. And
yeah,
it hit a little harder than he thought it would. So I had to switch him out and start up again. He did issue one. Issue one still stands, and it's fantastic. It's such a great, you know, even though it's work from, I think, 4 years ago now. I think he did the work on that. I'm trying to remember. It was either 2010 or 2011.
2011, I think, is when the first issue came out. And you can actually get it now at monkeypepstudios.com. You can get it through Comixology. You can get it through a variety of different places, which we're going to talk about a little bit. But I want to start at the top with this idea of like the hero code, which is just, like, as I was saying before we started recording, it's like just... it's like rock and roll superheroes. I don't mean like they're superheroes with guitars. I mean, like, it's just straight, unironic, you know, like classic superhero storytelling. And then same with the Black Wraith. The Black Wraith is like the sort of like the pulp hero with the kid's sidekick. He's like the, you know, he avenges by night. He fights bucket-headed Nazis. he's got like, he's kind of cut from the cloth of guys like the Shadow, Zorro, Batman, the Green Hornet, etc. So I'm wondering, I mean, you've got a fascination with like the straight up pulpy superhero story. I'm just wondering if there's like a story behind that. Like, where does that come from?
I think there's two kind of angles to it. One is that I grew up in England, in London in the 70s and 80s, and it wasn't a particularly colorful and fun place. It was, I kind of had two paths that I could go down with comic books, which was there was a strong anti-establishment punk movement in comics, and it was very rough and ready and angry at the people in charge. And at the same time that I was reading books like 2000 AD and Warrior and things that went down that path, I was also finding jumble sales, stacks of old Silver Age comic books and Bronze Age comic books. And, you know, I just, that was the world that I got into. That was that, like, that Bill Mantlo and J.M. DeMatteis and creators like that who gave, they told character stories, but the draping was always very colorful and traditional superhero stories. You know, it had gone through the crazy period of the Silver Age where it was science and sidekicks, and then it had come out this other side where it was character driven but superhero stories, and that was really what got me into comics in a massive way.
So that was your imprinting moment.
Yeah. Definitely. And you know, I'm not gonna play a violin here, but it's I didn't have the world is grim enough, you know. I don't need to add to the real world. And I think there is a tendency now, like you said before, that there's this kind of, people feel like they can't tell superhero stories because they have to ignore the absurdities of it. They have to kind of act like that didn't happen. And I think it's important to embrace that and get past it, because that's where the good stories are. I think they're the other side of the absurdities, rather than ignoring it and pretending it didn't happen.
You wouldn't have to be referring to Mr. Goyer's remarks recently, would you?
yeah, exactly. I mean, it's the Martian Manhunter is a fantastic character, and such a simple idea. It's someone who wants to learn about what humanity is, so he tends to be human.
Well, I mean, you know, you'll get no argument from me on that front.
We could violently disagree about this for like half an hour. I'm sorry, we could violently agree about this for half an hour.
Vociferously agree. Yeah. And by the way, the Goyer thing I refer to, for those who don't know, guy wrote Superman movie, said some funny things, funny in the sense of quizzical things about superhero comics and the people who read them. And if you just do a search, you'll find a lot of angry missives on the topic. Did you read them?
Yeah. It's probably not worth your time to read.
Yeah.
But it is an example of a certain attitude out there about superheroes, that it's, you know, for the for the unwashed masses, and the elites know better. which is dumb. It's for, you know, for the, we're all three of us are all about the same age, and so we grew up on, you know, seeing Super Friends on TV. Well, I don't know if they had that in England, but we certainly did. And, you know, and Batman and Superman and Spider-Man and very, very unironic way of taking on superheroes. The irony really hit late 70s to the mid 80s, I think, is when that started coming into vogue. And, you know, and when you're a teenager at that age, you're like, oh my gosh, yeah, if Batman really existed, he would totally go and break that guy's pinky. So,
yeah, how cathartic to see that finally happen.
And then you get, you know, older, and you know, you can either, you know, forget the superheroes and leave them in your childhood, or you can, I think, come back around and embrace the purity of the concept of the superhero, which sounds like the three of us again here sitting in this room have sort of done that, you know, full circle come around. And
you know, I just finally saw the Lego Movie the other night.
I haven't seen it yet, so.
Oh my God, it is nearly perfect.
Oh yeah?
It is nearly, for me, it is nearly a perfect movie. And the last, I want to say the last 20 minutes of the film, I had this unique experience where I wasn't analyzing the story. That rarely happens when I'm watching a movie, right? Like I was actually so drawn in that I was just experiencing it and not doing that analytic eye thing where I'm like, oh, I wonder where they're going with this, and right. I wonder why they did that, you know. But like tears and laughter at the same time, where I'm both crying and laughing about what's happening at the same time. Oh my gosh, so good. And the thing was, the hero smiles. He's not mad about anything.
Almost for the whole film, I don't think that counts.
Yeah, I mean,
smiling or just being there and being involved in what's going on in a really light way, in a really fantastic way.
Yeah. He has his ups and downs like a hero should, but like he engages with the struggle in this kind of like, you know, I don't want to say flippantly optimistic, but in this optimistic way. And it just, the whole tone of the film was like, there were scary parts, man. I mean, like, Cloud Cuckoo Land, that whole scene, the bad thing that happens there, intense. But anyway, yeah, it's just like that epitomized. Like, and I'm watching that going like, why can't superhero movies feel like this for me?
Yeah.
Anyway, but to go back to talking about you, Jamie, and your work, is so we've established you got this love of like the colorful, like, you know, bombastic superhero story.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Self-publishing.
Yeah. Okay, yes.
So here's where I get to, and I'm gonna borrow some style from my friend Greg Schiegel, who does the Stuff Said Show podcast. Fantastic podcast, everybody should listen to stuffsaidshow.com. Finish this one first, though. you're doing superhero comics, and you are doing, you're self-publishing them, so you're trying to reach new audiences, obviously, with this kind of thing. So superhero comics, that audience is being serviced. We got Jeff Johns, Jamie. What do we need you for after all? We've got Dan Slott. We don't need any more superheroes. I'm a Superman man. My son's going to be a Superman man, and his son's going to be a Superman man. How do you... Because I ran into this with when I was doing The Front, this graphic novel I did, which was superheroes, but it was like my kind of way of doing it. And like, I'm trying to reach new audiences. So I go to indie shows and like, oh, superheroes, whatever. A guy's got lasers coming out of his eyes. This is not for me. And then I go to the traditional comic shows and they'd be like, what's this? This isn't Aquaman. I'm an Aquaman man. Get out of here, punk.
Yeah.
So question from a self-publisher standpoint, how do you think about differentiating yourself and positioning yourself so as to get past those two resistance points when you're doing superhero work?
I think I've been lucky in a way in that the mainstream superhero community is kind of doing a lot of the work for me. They're restricting their market so much, and they've kind of collapsed it down to the only way that they can keep servicing the characters and the fans of the characters that they have is to either create new ideas on the old characters, which for me have kind of run their course. The stories have run their course, and they're kind of rehashing old ground a lot of the time. And also by convincing people that there's value in product that's already out there. So they've gone back to the speculator market in a massive way. Mm. But I think the biggest problem that they have, and this is to my benefit in a massive way, is that they're their target audience is restricted down to white 30 to 40 year old males that are the comics just don't work for kids anymore, you know. And I know there's always the old comics aren't for kids, comics are for kids, comics should be for everybody.
Right.
There's schools that always argue. And I think that, like, if you pick up a DC book or a Marvel book, most of them are T+. Most of them are priced in a way that isn't accessible for kids to get a lot of them, but they are written in a way that you need to read a lot of them to follow a story. And a lot of the time, the content is very much not suitable for everyone. And they've also alienated a lot of female readers. And I've found that, especially the Black Rape, has become, there's a lot of females that really enjoy that character. They really like the tone and the style and the world that he exists in. And so it's interesting. The shows I've been to, I still hit the same walls. I still hit people coming up and they're saying, who is this? That looks like that guy. I'm not going to bother reading that. You know, and, you know, you really see, if you have prints, any kind of comic book show, then, you know, unless it's Superman, Batman, Wolverine, et cetera, Deadpool, you don't have a chance in anyone being interested. They might come by and say, oh, that's a nice image. And then they move on. Yeah. That's the best that you get. But, even with that going on, I've still found that there's a group of people that still come up and say, that reminds me of stuff I used to read. I'll read that because I haven't read a DC or Marvel book for 5 years, 10 years, however long. And, you know, the Jeff Johns and Dan Slott do their work very well, but they're also, it's kind of become like a jocks and geeks thing almost, where their world is like the jock geek and people just want to read for fun, or the geek or whatever you want to call it, whatever you want to term it, have been either picking up classic stuff or going back and reading old stuff, or they're looking for new stuff that is in that style. And I think it kind of works. It kind of works to that audience to kind of pick up what the mainstream comics have ignored and left behind.
I think you just discovered the new advertising strategy for DC Comics. Are you a bad enough dude to read our comics? And they get Jocko, the Energizer guy. Remember him? The Australian guy?
Oh, yeah.
It's just him lifting weights like, are you man up for comics?
It's okay. Almost like they don't want to be seen as geeky anymore. You know,
yeah.
It's like, look how tough these guys are.
Yeah.
You know, they get women, they hit people, you know.
They get women, they hit people. And
that's the blurb for every.
And that's okay in small doses, but you don't want that to be your entire entertainment, you know, buffet. No, when you want to be able to, we've lost your seat. You know, you want to be able to go up to that buffet and say, oh, you know, today I feel like romantic comedy superheroes, or I feel like retro throwback superheroes, or I feel like superheroes for kids. And having more than two companies doing superheroes, I think, can, when a company gets in that, you know, tunnel vision way of doing their product, and it is product, mm-hmm. Then you have advantages, you know. You can do whatever you want with the Black Wraith. You know, there's no corporate overlord saying Batman wouldn't do that, and changing their mind from week to week what Batman is going to do, so you don't know. What
we need to change
do.
The costume so he matches what looks like in the movie,
right? Or anything like that. You know, it's your creation. You can do what you want to with it.
Sure. But yeah, but I think the thing that's interesting about, and like, at least in my experience, Jamie, and you can like chime in with it, whether yours is harmonious with this or discordant with this, is this sense that when you're doing something that feels a little like it's in the same pool as something else that is well known, you can feel like the outsider screaming in, like, how do I make people realize how mine is different? Right.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. And there is a tendency. I think this is there's a problem with a lot of comics, is that they become obsessed with the pitch or with the thing that makes it different and with the selling point. And, you know, they forget that there is a story. There is something that you need to have. You need to have a start and a finish. And I think that with superhero stuff, there is a natural start and finish with these things. These characters, the perpetuity of Batman and Superman has kind of run its course in a massive way that, you know, the fact that they had to reset the entire line of DC Comics to make it seem fresh is kind of indicative of that. But it's if you treat it like there is a story, like these are real people and that they have real personalities and they have a start and a finish, then I think the interplay becomes more interesting throughout it, and the writing becomes more interesting. And then, you know, it's the artist brings it into the four color world and the classical look, and then you have what I used to read, which was, you know, you pick up a copy of like the Defenders. I don't know if you ever read that.
Oh yeah, yeah, that was a great comic.
Yeah, it was a great book, and it had all these crazy supernatural elements and stuff like that. But it was still, I remember sitting there for ages reading a single issue because it was two people talking about their feelings whilst they were fighting a demon, or they were. Yeah. That was what made it more real for me. And the Justice League books were always about the interplay of the characters rather than the event. The event was just.
I'm assuming that you've read the Defenders that came out probably 10 years ago by Busiek, yeah, and Larson and Sal Buscema. Oh my gosh, that thing was just like a revelation. Like, yeah. I saw it on the shelf and I'm like that looks really. Hey, it's Larson. I love Larson's work. And then I open it up. I'm like, oh, this is what comics felt like when I was a kid. And that one issue that ended with the Hulk and Orca, the killer whale, punching each other at the bottom of the ocean. And it was just like, and you knew they were going to fight forever because like Hulk's like, keep on punching me because the angrier I get, the stronger I get. And Orca's like, well, keep on punching me because the more whales I summon, the stronger I get. And that's how it ends, just with them fighting at the bottom of the ocean forever.
And then next issue like doesn't reference that at all, no, right? Yeah, that's fantastic. I don't need to see how that fight ends. I just need to know that it happened, because the fight I see in the page probably won't be as good as the fight that just happened in my mind.
Well, that's
right?
True, yeah. But I mean, this is the kind of stuff that you find in things like The Black Wraith. Like, when I'm reading it, like, you're seeing they're fighting bucket-headed Nazis in not in an ironic way. And, like, you know, evil women named the Red Pen. And while they're having this awesome fight scene, the Black Wraith and his sidekick are having a discussion, right? They're having character exchanges and interactions while this is happening. That's another thing that's like really refreshing to see is like dialogue. dialogue that reveals character. That I hate to say it, but that is a refreshing thing to see in superhero comics, you know?
Yeah. Yeah.
I know there's a
kind of fear of people have got so obsessed with a period in comics that was a success outside of comics. Mm-hmm. That they feel like they have to keep aspiring to that. And it's that was a moment. That was a moment that happened. And there's been moments in the past where successful things happen. Like when Marvel launched, that was a huge success. But that was in the past. That worked at that period. And then they moved on. And then, you know, you have the 80s series of books and Frank Miller and Alan Moore and people like that. That was a moment. That was them doing their best work at that time. And now you have this kind of weird obsession with trying to convince people that this could happen in real life, and it can't. That's the joy of it. It's comics. They shouldn't happen in real life. And now there's that. You combine that with that need to make everything cinematic and speak to an audience that is used to a certain style, and you jettison an entire model of work and a method of telling a story that doesn't work. And you know, there's too many people prodding the beast, and it's kind of saying, well, that wouldn't work, and it's forgetting what does work and what works well for that method, that storytelling method.
All right,
got told that someone said that one of my books was too wordy, and I was kind of proud. That's a complaint. It's, you know, it's that they should be. You should sit down and read them for a long while.
Actually, it's funny. One of my book recommendations I got this week one of the reasons I chose it is because I like to point out how it has really good image and text density. you know, and like it's so weird that we have to say that now. But yeah, you know, when I see comics where like there's no sound elements at all, and they're like, "Well, I'm letting the images tell the story," I'm like, "Yeah, but sound elements and dialogue are image elements as well, and they can be used for composition, and they can also be used to reveal things about the character's motivations, and they can give you like an extra texture to the story." And I don't know about you guys, but you know, my favorite books, I hear the characters' voices when I'm reading them, right? Like, when you think of Benjamin Grimm, The Thing, you hear Jack Kirby's voice coming out of that guy, right? So, yeah, when it's done well, it's done really well. But anyway, I want to think of this idea about self-publishing. So you're self-publishing.
Yes.
And as I was thinking about this topic in the lead-up to the show, I was like, well, what's changed the most in the last 10, 20 years? And I wrote down this list. So 1994... And when I was really first starting out in, you know, self-publishing comics, we had Diamond, and we had a handful of other smaller distribution channels.
So was Capital dead by then?
No, not yet.
So there's Diamond and Capital. They were both nationwide distributors. Yeah. And then you had your lots of regional distributors.
Yeah, like Friendly Franks and a few other ones like that. Yeah, so you had that. And then you had mini comics and zines, right?
Right.
And then you had conventions. That was really the three avenues you had at that time if you were going to go into self-publishing, I think.
Pretty much, yeah.
Okay, let's fast forward to 2004. And now we're getting into the, you know, like the bold new age. All right, we got Diamond. And that's it. because there was like the whole distributor wars that happened. It was a big crossover event. And, and only Diamond survived.
And things will never be the same.
Yeah. The High Evolutionary came down and said, oh, Diamond, you get to win. And nobody else gets to win. And then we had mini comics and zines, you know. And then we had web comics. All right, we got web comics now, and we had conventions. And as far as I know, that was still pretty much it, right? Is we didn't really have the POD, the self-published or the print on demand stuff for another couple years yet.
Yeah,
it was like 2006, I think.
Yeah, it was very nascent if it existed.
Yeah, then, I think so. Comics Press or was that the first one? That was like 2004, 2005, but it was like it was very rugged at that time.
And it had a really bad reputation because it was so they were learning as they were going, and they got a very bad reputation, which I think hurt them in a massive way. So.
Yeah, it was a rocky start, I remember. I remember a lot of people were very frustrated. And let's face it, like cartoonists, and Jamie, you work with cartoonists all the time, we can be a very needy, emotional lot at times. I'm sure at times the complaints were legit, but then I also saw a lot of complaints where it was like, wah, you know, this didn't happen the way I thought it would. I'm going to make a big public temper tantrum out of the thing.
Yeah.
Okay, let's go 10 more years forward. Jump into the TARDIS. And what do we got now? 2014. We've got Diamond. We've got mini comics and zines. We've got conventions and web comics. But now we got print on demand. We got Kablam. We got Amazon CreateSpace. We've got Kindle Direct Publishing. We got Comixology, we got iBooks, we got Google Books, we got Kickstarter, we got Patreon, we got Gumroad, we got Sellify, Etsy. Drive-Thru Comics is a place where you can get the Black Wraith as well, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
So we got all this stuff now. All right, an embarrassment of riches.
which means
Jamie works a day job, right? I mean, you work in television, glamorous television. You can follow my Instagram to see some of the production shots. I mean, actually, you know, I think it's pretty cool that you work as a sound guy, because as a guy who like thinks about sound a lot in my comics, I'm sure you think about sound a lot.
Yeah, it's always been my obsession. When I was a kid, when I went to see Star Wars, that was the thing I came out. It wasn't the special effects, it was the sound effects that really sold me on that movie.
Oh, that's funny. Yeah, because I can listen to like Ben Burtt's commentary on the sounds he did in Star Wars like for days.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I watched the Clone Wars, the animated series that...
Mm-hmm.
And I was so into that series purely because they used all the sound effects. I don't even care what the story.
Closed your eyes and just sat there and listened to the show.
Yeah. Well, if I remember right, like going back a pace, like to the Art and Story days, I remember when we were trying to upgrade our equipment, and we were getting a lot of feedback from listeners saying, like, we don't care about the sound quality. All we care about is the content. You can do it as raw as you want to. And I remember thinking, like, we really should sound better. And I think you were one of the only guys who came out and said, no, if it sounds really good, it actually makes it a more pleasurable experience to listen to the thing. Please, you know, get better equipment. But yeah, yeah. So like you think about sound a lot, which actually I think trickles down into your comics when you read them, because like there's sound effects in there too, which is so exciting. But okay, but you got a day job and you have children, you know? I mean, you're a dad, you're working, and then you're trying to do this comics thing. You're trying to write them. You got to be creative. I got to come home. I got to get into the zone. I got to write some things, and I got to negotiate with artists and work with artists. And then, you know, this guy didn't understand this in the script. Oh, he gave me the page and it looks all weird. Oh, the colorist did this panel. So you're doing a lot of stuff. And now you have to think about all this other stuff, you know? Am I going to get it carried through Diamond? Am I going to do his Ashcan mini comic? What conventions am I going to hit? I got to get the Amazon version up. I got to get the Comixology version up. So first big question.
Mm-hmm.
When all these new services and platforms come out, and there's going to be more, right? Yeah. Patreon is new, and you're on Patreon, actually. It's patreon.com/JamieGamble, right?
Yes.
Okay. That's where you can support this stuff. What's your initial reaction when one of these new services come out, right? Like, and what I mean by this is, like, are you like, I don't know, I better wait and see? Or are you like, oh, this is interesting, I might take a look? Or are you excited? Like, all right, another thing I get to try? Or is it more like, oh, I got to do another thing? What's Jamie Gamble's initial, I want to get your worldview on navigating all this stuff. What's your initial reaction when one of these new things comes out?
Sometimes it's all of them. For me, it tends to be more like, I like new things happening. I like seeing what the new things can offer and, you know, what their spin on the old idea is. I'm not trying to claim I'm a pioneer or anything, but I don't like waiting to see if something is going to be a success. I want to try it and see for myself, because, you know, one man's success is another man's failure, and you never know what you're going to get. You never know what person is going to be interested in your work and how they found it. So I find trying it fascinating. I've always been obsessed with statistics and numbers and stuff like that anyway, so it kind of plays into that obsession for me, where I can look up things and see stats as they happen. And you know, Gumroad is a really good one for that, because you're instantly told if someone buys it and how many people are looking at it and how much they're paying and stuff like that. So there's all these numerics that I find fascinating. So I like trying new things. I think there is I try not to spread it too thin on similar models and similar systems of delivery. And I think there's enough difference between Gumroad, drive-through, Comixology, and Patreon to justify putting something, the same thing, on all of those. And there's no exclusivity to any of them as well, which I find interesting. And there's little tweaks that you can do in each of them, where you offer different versions of the same thing across that platform. Mm. So I like playing around with the new things. I like looking at the new delivery methods and the new techniques of getting stuff out there. The Comixology one especially has been a steep learning curve for me. I know enough about Illustrator and a few other programs from a couple of office jobs that I've had in the past and design stuff that I've done in the past that I can play around with it, but I am terrified of doing too much with it. And Comixology was really, they have a very strict criteria for stuff. They have a real high benchmark for their stuff, for the quality of the product, and not just the creative quality, but the actual product quality.
So you're preparing the pages in Adobe Illustrator for submission to Comixology?
I actually was doing a really roundabout way. I was the process I have is that I have the scripts are all collected in one place, normally on Google Drive, and then I share those out with the people that I'm working with, the collaborating team, and then the artist will deliver them through Box, and then that allows us to comment back and forth and discuss stuff whilst I'm at work, because you can do it on your phone and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. And you can preview pages and so forth. And then once they've done that, it goes to the colorist who does their work, and I think they probably do their stuff in Photoshop. And then it goes to the letterer who does it in Illustrator. And then what I get is uploaded, I get the kind of oversized raw page that is the finished page, but I still need to size it to make sure it fits to the spec of everything that I'm going through and make sure that everything is CMYK or RGB or go through all that process. And what I was doing was I was going into Illustrator, resizing the pages in Illustrator to go into a traditional print comic book size. Then I was opening up a graphics converter and going into that and then resizing them to the Comixology spec, which they have a minimum width, pixel width that each page has to be. And when I was doing that, I think I was converting from TIFF to JPEG and then going into iCombiner to create the PDF that I would send to them.
Oh my gosh.
It was completely convoluted. And I think I had a couple of rejections from Comixology where there was issues of pixelation, and it's something in that process that was compressing somewhere that I didn't need to do. And I since, with their help, they were very helpful. They sent me a guideline, and I've gone through some other processes and spoken to a few people on Twitter, and they've been very helpful as well. I basically moved everything into InDesign and do everything there.
Okay,
in there, and then just drop all of the original TIFFs in there and shape them in there and size them in there and then create a PDF from that. And it saved me a lot of time.
I was gonna ask, like, are you still using this Rube Goldberg machine to make your comics?
Gentlemen.
But yeah,
I'm now doing that, and that has saved me a lot of time. It means that the files are a lot bigger, and that's that's the main thing now, is that I save everything as the raw individual TIFF pages that I can go back to at any point if I need to adjust anything. But then I create a PDF for print, and I create a PDF for digital, and they go to the different services from there.
And your InDesign becomes sort of like your master file.
Exactly. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So I wonder if we can dig at that Comixology thing just for a few minutes. Because I have zero experience with Comixology, and I've been meaning to try out the platform for a long time. Mm-hmm. I mean, I have it and I buy comics on it, but I haven't put my comics on it.
Yeah.
How has your experience been overall? I mean, is this a place where you would say, like, hey, if you're an independent, because I was under the, one of the reasons I was dragging my feet is I was under the impression that, oh, it's kind of a DC Marvel place. It's a place mm-hmm. for if you're doing, you know, what was that you said again, David? I get lots of girls that I hit people. Where, I thought that was the place where you go to get those kind of books mostly, and I found some independent stuff on there too. Yeah. But I thought, like, really the audience was the hitting people comics. So what was your reaction to that?
Well,
experience.
There's definitely that is a big part of it, but I think they release the global charts for stuff, and you can see a real difference from country to country what interests people. And I think the two main things for me is, one, the Comixology Submit is the independent imprint there, or the independent arm of Comixology, which is where all my stuff goes up on there, and there's a lot more interesting and diverse stuff offered there. But the other thing is the scope and scale of the reach that they give you as a creator is massive. It's the only player in town by far. It's everything else has kind of collapsed down. Graphically was around for a while, and that is now gone. Mm-hmm. Drive-through is very good, but it seems like it's a very small niche area of the internet that people go to get their books from there. But Comixology definitely has the reach that it's the equivalent of getting into Diamond. You know, it's getting your book in front of a lot of eyes and a lot more people than you normally could. And I think that because of the combination of it being a global app and the scale of what they of how they offer it, I think that opens it up a lot more than people realize. I think we have a tendency in the US and many ways in the UK as well, to think that comics are superheroes and that is the be all and end all. But you can look on Submit and you can see that that is still, if you go to the Comixology homepage, it 9 times out of 10 it will be a picture of Batman or Wolverine up there. But I wonder if that's different around the world. And you can see in the charts as well, there are books that chart a lot higher than Batman and Superman in different parts of the world. you know, in India, Brazil, Russia, places like that, there's a definite desire for something outside of the realm of superheroes in Marvel and DC.
Hmm. Yeah, that is an interesting thing to point out, is the global aspect that I admit I wasn't even thinking about that. I was thinking of it as a national thing. That's silly. How 20th century of me. So you can actually, and that's another thing, you get like some measurement and statistics. You get like a feedback loop on how well the stuff is doing there.
You get a quarterly report.
Okay.
And that breaks down, that shows you each individual purchase of the book and which country it was bought in. The way they work, off the top of my head, I think it's something like the payout system is that you have an account with them, and once your money earned goes over $100, you get a payout from them, or you get sent a payment from them, and you set up with them. So there is a lot of times where you're 6 or 9 months of watching these numbers slowly creep up because they're out there. But yeah, you do get a breakdown. You get a very good quarterly breakdown of everything. I got Department O was part of the South by Southwest package. They offered a package at South by Southwest, which was, I think it was like 100 titles, maybe 50 or 100 titles for $10 through the submit service, because it was very it was pushing the indie side of it.
Oh, that's cool.
And yeah, I got a book on the Department O got through that, and I haven't seen the official quarterly report, but I know a few people who also had their books on there, and they said that there was around 5,000 downloads of that package, so the book was out to 5,000 people. So it'll be interesting to see. I know that's a huge spike from what I normally move on there, but it'll be interesting to see.
Okay, well, this brings up another thing. You're talking about, you got global reach. They have the reach. It's like getting into Diamond was language, they said. I had a book in Diamond once. and I think I sold, I think it was like 4 copies that I sold.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow.
And so, I mean, like, you know, it's like, yeah, you got a numbers game going on here where it's like, wow, a lot of people are using this app and interacting with it. But then how do you get your stuff noticed? Now, here's why I want to go diverge on a slightly parallel or tributary topic to this. Is that, Dave, before we started recording, we were talking about, I said to you, I was like, oh, well, where do you order books for your library? Because like, when we did an episode a long time ago, Know Your Selector, which is the name of the episode, I'll look it up for the show notes, where I talked with Sharon Iverson about how to get your books into public libraries.
Right.
You work in a university library, which is a different animal.
Right.
And so I was like, oh, well, you probably go through Baker and Taylor or Ingram or something like that. You're like, no, I go through Diamond.
Yeah. So, I mean, because I'm buying for a different purpose than the public libraries are, right? I can't speak for all public libraries. I'm going to speak very generally here. So you'll forgive me if your particular situation.
He's Dave Reed's Comics on Twitter.
Yeah. Direct all your hate mail, your hate tweets, only 140.
My library is not like that, Mr. Carter. Anyway, but continue, sorry.
Generally, they're looking for stuff where they want them to circulate. You know, you're going to buy stuff, you want it to circulate as much as possible. You want to get the popular stuff in there. And you want to get, you know, they're like, here's the stuff that's good for you, and here's the stuff that's really popular. And hopefully there's some overlap in there between the good for you and popular stuff. Mm-hmm. But in general, you know, the public library, especially like for popular series, for a system like Ann Arbor, you know, they're going to be buying multiple copies of something, and they're going to be around on the shelf for maybe a couple years. You know, they'll go through, if it's popular, it'll get circulated a lot and it'll fall apart. If it's not popular, it'll sit there on the shelf and it'll get weeded after a year because nobody's checking it out, and then it'll go away. I'm buying stuff, you know, it's a tier one academic research library. So we have, not only do we want to buy stuff that people want right now, I'm also trying to imagine what people are going to want 20, 30 years from now, what they're going to want to get then. And I'm buying, you know, chiefly for an academic audience. And, you know, I've got a collection development statement, which says, you know, these are the sorts of things that we're looking for. And I'm looking for stuff that's creator driven, stuff that's, you know, independent kinds of stuff, stuff that is, you know, representing people and cultures and stuff that aren't have not traditionally been represented in comics. So I got kind of a lot of things that I'm going through. So the Bakers and Tailors of the world, who are really catering towards that public library audience, they're not necessarily carrying the sorts of stuff that I want. You know, I don't know. I haven't checked, but there's not too much of the small indie publishers in there. Not too much no brow press that you're going to find in there.
Right.
And those sorts of things. That's the kind of stuff that I want. Well, I can find a lot of that stuff in Diamond. Mm-hmm. We actually order our stuff through Vault of Midnight, which is the big comic store here in Ann Arbor. So every month I'm going through previews. I'm skipping over most of the DC stuff. Well, I order a few things out of the front of the catalog, you know, because you know, there's some interesting stuff in there and
sure.
things. I'm not going to paint with a big brush and say everything that Dark Horse publishes is crap, because it's clearly not the case.
No, then we've joined the dark side, right? When we start talking like that. Excuse me, do you realize that Dark Horse is garbage? Yeah. We're not going to be that.
I'll pick some stuff out of there that's interesting, but I do most of my buying out of the middle third of previews, before you get to the toys, you know, and sort of the smaller press publishers. And I sit there, I put together my spreadsheet and send it off to Vault of Midnight, and then they ship the books to us. And then, so if you can get yourself in previews, if you can get Diamond to carry you, I'm likely to at least see your see that your thing is available. Mm-hmm. Now, there's more in previews than I can possibly buy.
Of course.
You know, I'm buying maybe 10%. I'm pulling a number out of nowhere in there. So there's lots of worthy stuff that I'm not able to afford to buy every month. But I try to get the highlights, and I try to get stuff... you know, something catches my eye in that little tiny box ad in there. Something about that says, go ahead and buy that. You know, Dave, it's $15 or $20 or something like that. Which, you know, I used to buy engineering books for the library, mm-hmm. you know. So, you know, books that are costing $200, you know, a piece.
I'm like, that's true, yeah.
$20, I'll take a chance on that. So if you can catch my attention in there, then, you know, other than that, it's hit or miss. You know, if you can get my attention through your Kickstarter thing, or I see somebody tweets about it, you know, and I say, oh, they usually have good taste in comics. Let me go to that website and check that thing out. Mm-hmm. Or if it's a creator whose work I'm familiar with and they're publishing in some odd platform and I know that it exists, then I can go out, you know, and try to find it.
Like if James Michalka is doing a Kickstarter for a thing, you're going to notice.
Right.
Yeah.
So name recognition can be a thing, because that's very hard if you don't have the big name recognition.
Right.
So you got to kind of get out there and do the podcast and be on the social media and send yourself out to people. Send your review copies out to blogs and places like that. Because, you know, once you can get on somebody's radar, then, you know, there's a sort of explosive effect. No, that's not the
great
analogy.
Now the NSA is listening to us.
That's not the analogy I was going for.
No, but I think this is an interesting angle on the whole thing, is that I've been talking for years about how public libraries are the place where cartoonists need to get their work, because when you have one book in a library, that means hundreds of people are going to have access to it and see it. We're talking about reach again, right?
Yeah.
But if you're an independent publisher, that becomes a very difficult thing to do, because the main inroad mechanism is unavailable to you. And unless you want to go to every individual library and try to strike up a conversation with their selector, you're up against something there. But it's interesting that there is a value to previews for an independent publisher if you want to get into an academic library. Because now...
I don't know that other academic libraries are doing what I do.
I imagine there's got to be more than just you and, like, you know, places like the Billy Ireland Museum. And right? I mean, there's it's a growing movement. But, yeah, I mean, I'm sure that you are in an elite vanguard right now. But I gotta think that that's growing.
I hope so. I think comics should be everywhere.
But I mean, I'm just saying, like, it's interesting that, like, while you don't necessarily have CERC numbers, you, by having that collection there, you are exposing that work to a lot of people.
Right, right.
You know, a lot of people use the Duderstadt.
Yeah.
And I mean, I use it. I go there to read comics. So, I mean, it's actually, I think it's one of the top places to get really, really, actually, it takes me back to the days when I fell in love with the medium and I started discovering people like Bill Willingham back in like the late 80s before he was Fables Bill Willingham, you know.
Right, when he was doing Elementals and stuff.
Yeah, and I was like, they tripped this thing. Like, I discovered Kimiko Comics and like Matt Wagner and stuff.
Yeah, there's that point when you suddenly became aware that there's more than Marvel and DC and Archie out there.
And that's what the Duderstadt is for me. It's like, what haven't I seen yet?
Yeah.
I can find it there, right?
It used to be, you know, you'd go to a good comic store in a big city or something like that. Because, you know, when you went down to the neighborhood drugstore and the spinner rack and stuff like that. There wouldn't be a lot of choices of what to get there. And you say, oh, they do these in black and white, and they do things. there's more, you know.
Yeah, I remember that.
You're like, oh my gosh, and then you realize that there's this whole subculture of independent comics out there.
I was 13, and I was at a comic store, my very first like real comic store with a friend, and we opened up some Mirage Studios stuff, and we're like, it's in black and white. Why is it in black and white? And like my friend says, I think that means it's for grown-ups. Like, yeah, that must be it.
these turtles that are running around and hitting people with nunchucks must be for grown-ups, yeah.
Anyway, but okay, so there's other avenues to, like, if you go through previews, and I mean, you got the Comixology app in front of you right now, so you're getting exposed to stuff that way. You're a savvy librarian, a crusty old librarian.
You know, I like to go down to the Comixology submit new releases, and, you know, and you page through there, and there might be one or two things that catches my eye, so you can't click the buy button anymore.
Yeah.
That's a whole other conversation. You can go onto the website and purchase it, and then go through that convoluted Amazon way of downloading your stuff to your iPad.
Yeah.
But it is still more convenient than going to a store and hoping that store carries that comic.
Actually, yes. Yeah.
Because shelf space is infinite, really, in the digital realm. Now, there's a problem with that, and that, you know, it's hard to get to some of this stuff to find out that it even exists, even if it's on the Comixology app. You know, it might be on that Comixology submit new releases thing for maybe a week or two, and then it's buried down in there.
Mm-hmm.
So you if you want to get that long tail effect on your digital comic, you almost constantly have to be out there pumping people's attention for it to let them know that it exists, because just putting it on the virtual shelf doesn't mean that people are going to see it or know that it's there.
Well, that's you anticipated where I wanted to go with this, Jamie. You know, how do you? I mean, because Black Wraith just dropped on Comixology today. So everybody who's listening now, fire up your app, go to Comixology submit new releases and check out Black Wraith today twice. Get a copy for a friend. I'm stealing that from Dean Tripp, who was just on the show recently. He was saying that about one of his digital comics. So buy three. How do you think about this? How do you think about, like, how do I get this noticed? I mean, is it just like what Dave was saying, like just the outreach, going onto the social medias, getting people, awesome people like Jeremy Burley to talk about you? Because when Jeremy Burley talks, people listen. Like E.F. Hutton.
I've realized, you go on Twitter now and you realize that even the mainstream publishers and even the creators that are working on mainstream books use that model. They still need to, they've got a whole department, a marketing department behind them, but they still have to go on to Twitter and Facebook and announce when stuff is happening, because I think that's how most people become aware of it. And, you know, I've done a couple of Kickstarters, and I realized that the first time you start plug in a Kickstarter that you're doing, you just feel like, oh my God, people are going to be so sick and tired of hearing this. And, you know, day one of 30, and you do it three times, and there's the whole don't do it more than this many times. But then on, you know, you'll be on day 10 and someone will say, oh, I didn't realize you were doing that. And you realize that it's such a living world now, social media. It's not just like forums where you post something and it sits there and people respond to something that's set there. It's actually breathing and moving and changing, especially Twitter. You can post on Twitter and it's gone within a couple of minutes, and it's bad. Yeah,
if it's not there in those first couple pages when I'm scrolling through the however many hundred people I'm following,
yeah,
I might not see it.
That's true.
And I just remembered Steve Lieber, who's going to be one of the guests at the thing we're going to be talking about in just a minute.
Yep.
Tweeted yesterday, pro tip, never ever publicize your own work. Your publisher has your best interest at heart and will always take care of that for you. And if you could hear Steve's voice, you'll feel the sarcasm dripping off that tweet.
Yeah, there was a wry smile at the end of that one. Yeah, so, okay, that's actually, I think you're speaking to, Jamie, this an assumption that was in the back of my head with, like, because I think about, there's advice, like, don't just tweet your thing once a day, right? Yeah. You got to do it multiple times a day because people won't see it otherwise. And I'm like, oh, but what about that person who I'm going to annoy? What about that one guy who I'm going to annoy with saying it twice?
You can say it differently three times during the day.
That's
right?
True. That's true.
But, you know, there's people who check their Twitter at morning and people in the afternoon and in the evening. And so it's okay to do it three times a day. And and believe me, most people on Twitter aren't just following five people.
That's true, yeah. They're only following me, right? They're only following me. but it's like, I think about that, and when you just brought that up, Jamie, I remember when the Kickstarter was going on, and I don't remember at any point being like, oh, there's Jamie again. But I think part of that is that you have a delightful presence, too. It's like, I never read anything that Jamie says, and I'm like, oh, well, he's at it again.
Yeah, I mean, yeah. I do find it obnoxious when all a creator does on Twitter is publicize their own work.
Yeah, you know, I think Twitter is definitely a conversational thing.
Yeah,
I like to see people ask questions. I like to engage with people on there, and you know, I've got incredible advice from people on there, and bounced ideas back and forth with people on there. So I think it's a real valuable tool in that respect.
It's not a place for deep conversations about things, but it's definitely a party sort of thing, right? You know, you're hanging out and you're just talking. Instead of talking about the weather, you're talking about comics or whatever it is you're talking about.
If you need to tweet more than three tweets about us as a single response, then you know that it's not the place.
Until you get caught up in an Eric Larson thing again, where he gets mad about something and then he starts talking, and then it's easy to get caught up in those. I usually get caught up in reading them more than responding, but he knows how to fire people up. Eric J. Larson on Twitter, people should follow him. All right, so we got to get to book recommendations. I cannot believe it. We just burned through an hour, Jamie. It goes so fast. And I always say, I always look at the clock and I'm like, okay, well, we're at 15 minutes out. We got to start wrapping up for book recommendations. And then usually that's when a really interesting idea hits, and then we go down that path. And then all of a sudden it's 1:30 and we got to wrap. But before we get to book recommendations, I want to shift gears entirely. And we got to talk about an event that's happening, Dave.
That's right. So we got Kids Read Comics, which is the thing that you and Dan Mishkin and folks here at AADL and probably some other people I'm forgetting, so I apologize, organized this wonderful free celebration of comics for kids. Yeah. It's kind of a convention, but it's more than that.
It's like a festival.
Yeah. Where you'll have artists who specifically do comics for kids and teens, all tabling and doing giving seminars and doing quick draws and interacting with the fans. I would say probably at a deeper level than your typical convention.
I would say yes. That the way I describe it is like when you think about when we were kids and we go to conventions, like, oh, you get to go get a thing signed by George Perez.
Right.
Kids Read Comics is the event where you go and George Perez says, hey, you want to draw with me?
Yeah.
And think about like the difference in the profundity of that that experience, right?
So this will be our second year of doing a pre-conference for that. We did this last year, the Comics in the Classroom pre-conference, and it went really well last year. So we're doing it again. So it's going to be on Friday, which is the day before Friday, June 20th, which is the day before Kids Read Comics proper starts. And this will be at most of the activities are going to be at the Harlan Hatcher Graduate Library on the University of Michigan's central campus. And it's intended for librarians and teachers and cartoonists, all three groups holding hands,
kumbaya,
getting along, and it's all about how do you use comics in a teaching way, and how do cartoonists get in and work with educators, and how do educators bring comics into the classroom and use them as a teaching and learning tool, and how do librarians build collections that can support that? Mm-hmm. So the morning will be a repeat of the session that you gave last year, and which is the
how to teach a comics workshop, right, or how to teach comics even if you don't know how to draw, right, is the basic idea. And there's so much material in that workshop that I can do it probably five times in a row, and it'll never different. Be the same. Because it comes with a 61-page kit that like, even if you don't know anything about drawing, you can take that kit and take it into a classroom and teach a comics class, whether it's teaching how to make comics or using comics to teach another skill, right, like teaching math or teaching, yep, sociology, etc. So yes, that's the first session.
Yeah, and I sat in on that last year, and I learned stuff in there, and I can't draw worth a darn, as anyone who's seen my mini comics can attest to. So that was good. And then we're going to do a couple panels. The panels are going to be brand new. Yep. I was trying to bring the thing up here and talk at the same time, which I'm never good at here. So
yes, the panel is how to better integrate comics in the classroom is the big idea.
And you've got Colby Sharp moderating that panel. And the guests will be Matt Holm of Baby Mouse fame,
yeah,
and Ruth McNally Barshaw of Ellie McDoodle fame, and Sharon Iverson, who people who listen to this podcast will know well.
Sharon Iverson live!
And Jim McClain, who did Reading with Pictures, and a couple old friends of mine, Steve Lieber and Sarah Ryan, who have both done work for Dark Horse and
Marvel
and DC and folks like that. They'll be their former Ann Arbor folks who will be returning for this. So that will be a fantastic panel.
That is like the big crossover event again, right? I mean, like all the stars are coming out for this panel. It's, yeah, going to be a great one.
And so that's the 1:30 panel.
Yep.
And then the 4 o'clock panel is How You Read and Write Visually, Lean Into Artcast. You guys are going to do a live stream. You and
Rob Stenzinger.
Yeah, thanks.
Did we confirm that we're going to do a live broadcast too?
Okay, we haven't confirmed that yet. As far as I know,
it's conceivable.
Conceivable. We are planning to do it live. Assuming that our tech people can work and get that going, but I don't foresee any problems. But
okay,
you're right. We haven't confirmed that, so maybe I shouldn't be saying that we're going
to.
Well,
here's the thing: you should come to it in Michigan and see it live and participate in the live studio audience, because we're going to be talking about how everybody reads visually, right? And like, you are reading visuals when you are interpreting visual imagery. And so we talk about visual literacy. It turns out everybody reads visually, and we're going to unbox that with some guests on the Lean Into Artcast, broadcasted live from the Harlan Hatcher Graduate Library.
Yep. And in between the two panels, there'll be an event over at the University of Michigan Art Museum, mm-hmm, that will do sort of looking at art telling stories from a historical perspective, and mm-hmm, sort of how comics sort of fall into the whole history of art and using art to tell stories,
and how art has been using the tools of comics for centuries. And Dr. Chaburka of the University of Michigan Museum of Art walks us through it with a bunch of selected pieces of art, and he helps decode how, like, you know, all these different artists throughout history have been using comics storytelling techniques.
So that's your highbrow,
yes,
portion of the day for that. So how much does this all cost, Jersey?
Well, something like that, a pre-conference of that nature, I'm guessing $600-$700 a head, right?
You would think, but no.
Are you doing your Billy Mays now? Are you going to shout? But use your mic technique.
This is all free?
It is free to the public.
Just like Comic Street, great. Comics read great.
Kids read comics. There's too many darn comics words in the things I do.
But like Kids Read Comics proper, the pre-conference is free. We do ask, though, for the pre-conference that you register. Mm-hmm. And so hopefully Matt will be able to throw this URL up on the screen, but it's mlatcomics.com/krc/cccc. Mm-hmm. And you can go there. You can see the entire program out there. And then at the bottom of that page, there's a form. You're going to want to fill that out so that we know how many folks are coming. There's already people registered for this, and the morning session is rapidly filling up.
Oh, wow.
So if you want to attend, I would say try to do that in the next day or so.
Oh, wow.
We will waitlist people if we run over, because it's in a room, and there's only so many places to sit in there.
Mm-hmm.
The same with the event at the Art Museum. That's going to be limited to about 20, 25 people. But the panels, they're in a big room. There's plenty of space there.
Mm-hmm.
Even if you forget to register for those, you can show up for those, and we're not going to be checking your tickets at the door for those events. But we would like to know how much coffee to order and
that's right.
And
there's
like
going
to
be coffee, there'll be some kind of refreshments there. Yep. But yeah, that's it. Go to kidsreadcomics.org, and in the sidebar is an image that says "Comics in the Classroom." You can click that; it'll take you to the page where the registration form is.
Right.
And I am super excited about this. Oh, we should say the day concludes with a drink and draw.
That's right, over at Dominic's, which is a local watering hole that we did last time. So even if you're not able to come to any of the events, and you're a cartoonist type, and you're in town for Kids Read Comics, or you're just want to come and hang out with other folks who draw.
Yeah.
Last year we put a big sheet of butcher paper up on the fence, and people started doodling on it and drawing on it, and people having lots of fun and socializing with folks, and that was, I think that was one of the highlights of the day. And I'm not a hang out at the bar kind of person.
You're not.
I am not.
No, the favorite story I love to tell from this the drink and draw last year is it's in a restaurant, and we had like an area reserved for the artists to all just hang out, artists and librarians to hang out and draw together. And a family shows up, some kid with his parents, and they were just there for dinner for like, you know, their own reasons, right? They weren't there for our thing. The kid looks over and he sees some of his favorite authors. He sees Rafael Rosado. He sees Ben Hatke. He sees Raina Telgemeier all drawing on this wall. And he's like, "Can I go draw on the wall?" I'm like, "Yeah, you can go draw the wall." And so I'm thinking about it. I'm like, imagine you're 10 years old and your parents are like, "We're going out to dinner." You're like, "Ah, nuts. I want to watch TV. I got to go out to dinner with my family." And then you get there and Maurice Sendak is right over there. And he says, "Hey, you want to draw with me?" How awesome would that be? That'd be the best. So, yeah, that we got to provide that experience for that little kid.
Yeah.
That was so cool. But, yes, it's open to the public. You should come. Dominic's is an 18 or older place, so if you have or if you're under 18, you have to be accompanied by an over 18 or over 21, relative.
Yes, not just some guy you meet who will take you in. It's got to be a legal relative type person to get you in for that.
Jamie, what do I got to do to get you to come to Kids Read Comics one of these years?
Oh, I'll come. I definitely will come. I've been very slow to build my convention and festival presence, just because I've been I'm trapped in my day job where if I'm working I don't have the time, and if I'm not working I don't have the money, so I'm going to juggle that. I definitely do want to come. It's one of those shows I definitely do want to go to.
Well, that's a whole, we got to have you back, because that's a whole other avenue of discussion that I had in my notes for talking about how conventions figure into a self-publishing strategy, but we'll save it for another time, and maybe we can get some of your compatriots to come on for that one too. I haven't talked to Carl Anstatter in a long time. Need to get him on again too, so we'll do this again. But yes, people should go to kidsreadcomics.org. It's a month away. Oh, and one more thing about Kids Read Comics: this is episode 99 of Comics Are Great. Episode 100 will happen at Kids Read Comics during that weekend. We're going to do a broadcast of KRC. I'm going to be joined by co-host Greg Schiegel of the Stuff Said Show. We're going to do jointly run show together. Okay, so that's all about kidsreadcomics.org for now. So now book recommendations. Do we have any books that we want to promote?
Who wants to start?
Jamie, I don't know if I gave you time to think much about...
Yeah, no, you did. I've got a stack of... let's bring up this one here. Ooh. This was something I found on Kickstarter, and then I was at WonderCon. And the artist was on the table opposite me, so I actually went over and met him. And it's a book called Basewood by Alec Longstreth. He's been doing a series of they're kind of zine comics, I guess, that you can subscribe to from his site called Phase 7, I believe. Phase 7 comics, let me just check. Yes, and this was part of the... It's a beautiful book. It's a hardcover that he put out through Kickstarter. And it's part of a story that he ran in the Phase 7 series originally. I think it was like a 4 or 5 issue ongoing story, and normally it's very autobiographical, but this was like a little departure for him, and he did the Kickstarter to get the hardcover printed, and yeah, it's a beautiful, beautiful book. It's huge as well.
Wow, yeah, it's lovely looking. And I have not met him yet, but by all accounts, he is a very, very enthusiastic person who loves comics a lot.
Yeah, he tries to encourage everybody to create. So there's that. I've got a couple more, if that's right, if you want me to just run through them.
Please.
Plastic Farm, Rafa Roberts. Here's another guy. He's been putting this out as a self-published kind of zine comic as well. I think he's on issue 24 or 25 now. I think it's 24, and I'm always massively impressed with anyone who puts out that many books independently. He's on Patreon as well. But this is a collection, the first collection. He's got 3 collected editions. But I had the individual books, and then he did a Kickstarter, so I got the collected editions through that. And I've been backing him on Patreon. And one of the things he does on Patreon, which is kind of cool, is that you can get a hard copy of the book and a sketch card from him.
Wow. So yeah, physical bonuses.
Yes, exactly.
Almost said physical benefits, and that sounds like something else.
Still a family show jersey.
More, there's Old City Blues. I'm a big fan of Giannis Milogiannis. His work, in New Athens in the future. It's a kind of Blade Runner-esque story. Ties into that book. Not ties into, but it kind of plays along the lines of Blade Runner meets Pluto. He's a great creator. This is the second book, but he just seems to pour out work. He's like it's one of those creators that just seems to sit down and churn out work. And I love it. It's a great book. It's a really, really good read. And last one is, I say one, but it's a collection.
Oh my!
Oh wow!
Which is Evan Dahm's series. This is the new one, which is Batu. And again, this is all stuff that I found through Kickstarter and kind of backed up through Kickstarter. This is the second book he did, which is Rice Boy, which is the site that he publishes everything up on, which is rice-boy.com, I believe. Mm-hmm. It's like a huge fantasy series, ongoing fantasy series. This is the first arc, which was called the Order of Towers, book 1, 2, and 3. He's on like page 500 of the current story, and he puts out maybe 2 pages a week, and it's just beautiful stuff. It's so beautifully designed. I mean, this is the black and white early stuff, and he's getting better from there. It's like the second book kind of goes like almost like Yellow Submarine in some of the design work. Let's see.
Oh wow!
Yeah. And it's just really, it's so well written. The character interplay and the storytelling is beautiful. So I highly recommend that.
So all indie guys.
Yes. Oh, yeah. And another one, which I don't have to hand, it's over in my bedroom there, is Copra, Michael Fife's Copra, which is he's putting out a book. He did 12 issues monthly, self-published. And you can only get it through him, I think. I think he has an Etsy store, which he has books. There's a collected edition coming out. And it's great. He's play with time and panel design and how the eye flows across stuff and how you read it to match a certain pace that he wants is really well done. And I think that the collected edition is coming out soon. I think he's on issue 14 at the moment. He just had a subscription service up, which I got. So he's really good. It's like a Suicide Squad in the 80s story, like that Joe Ostrander kind of storytelling. Yeah. But he's a really good artist as well, so recommend that.
Very cool. And that actually reminds me of something I meant to say about the Hero Code and the Black Wraith, is that you can tell when you're reading them that you are definitely trying to maximize comics storytelling potential instead of writing something that, this could also be turned into a TV show down the road, you know? I mean, and it could, and that'd be great because that means money that you can make more things with, but I always appreciate it when I read a comic that feels like, oh, he's actually leveraging what makes comics or what makes comics so unique through his storytelling, right? Always appreciative of that. And I mean, the general reader, who cares? They don't care. But as a cartoonist, I always am delighted when I see it. I'm like, oh, that's nice. I'm glad he did that, you know? So, yeah, and it's obviously you're responding to that in other people's work as well. So, Dave Carter, what do you got?
Yeah, so I realized this weekend that I read a couple of comics that are set during the Revolutionary War. So, like, well, there's a theme. So I don't know where I hold this up here. Yeah, there we go. So this is the latest volume of The Black Coat. I guess it came out back in November. Ben Licious is writing it, and the art currently by Dean Kotz, although the earlier volumes, Francesco Francavilla was doing the art on that. And it's basically the Black Coat is sort of a Batman, Green Hornet type superhero, but he's operating in Boston, New York area during the Revolutionary War period.
Oh,
and,
wow.
And so this and he's sort of hooked up with the insurrectionists, and you'll go in and hitting those redcoats, you know, who are trying to stop the insurrection.
So
and
he's on our
he's
side.
On, he's on our. He's on
not the, on Jamie's side.
Right. I'm just, awful.
Yeah. And. And so, and there's also a sort of an occult element going on. There's a secret society of occultists out there who maybe are sort of helping the British, but maybe not really. Maybe they have their own agenda, and so they're sort of inserted into the mix. This is the fourth volume of it. It's called The Blackest Dye, and this one kicks off like on July 6, 1776. So they've sort of just declared independence, and the war has just officially begun. Mm-hmm. And now they're trying to get out of town before they get, you know, burned out by those nasty, vicious redcoats. Sorry, Dave.
I don't know. This sounds awfully educational to me.
Oh, well.
But it's got superheroes in it, right?
You might accidentally learn something when you're reading this. And I'm not a historian, so I have no idea how accurate the history is there.
Right.
But it's a ripping good, you know, superheroes set during the past sort of yarn. And the other one, I'll be surprised if Sharon hasn't mentioned this before in the podcast, The Dreamer by Laura Innes.
Yeah.
So I just read the second volume. This is actually a webcomic. You can go onto her website and read the whole thing for free. Mm-hmm. But if you're like me and you like the feeling of paper in your hands when you're reading your comics, IDW has published the collections of it. So this is a historical time travel romance comic. Where our main character, what's her name? Beatrice. Beatrice, she's a 17-year-old girl living in 21st century America going to high school. And one day when she falls asleep, she has this very vivid dream that she's back during the Revolutionary War. Mm-hmm. And she's hooked up with the insurrectionists. and you know, she falls madly in love with the one general or lieutenant or whoever it is. And there's a whole romance thing going on there. And then there's a romance thing going on in the present day. She wakes up. And she falls asleep in the dream world. She wakes up in the present day, and then the next day it happens again. She falls asleep and she goes back. So she's living these two lives. One is a dream, and one is reality. But it's romance. it's unabashed that sort of thing being told in a comic. There's no superheroes in here at all. But there are people doing heroic things because, you know, it's set during a time of great conflict.
Yeah.
So she's out there, you know, doing the stuff on the web and.
Well, yeah. Laura Innes is amazing, and she also does a show called the Paper Wings podcast. Which, if you're a fan of this show and the kinds of discussions you find here, you'll probably dig that as well. So you can.
So, 4th of July is coming up. So, you know, if you want to get in the mood for shooting off some firecrackers, there's a couple of good comics, I think, that'll do you well for that.
Ah, that's good. Nicely done. All right. My recommendation, I've recommended this before, and I only bring it up because I think this book shares a lot of DNA with the kind of work Jamie's doing. And if you go, first, I'm going to say go to Comixology and get The Black Wraith, which just came out today. Get that first. Then get this. So the Kids Comics Revolution Awards were just announced. The nominees were it's an award show, an award put on by the Ann Arbor District Library and me and Dave Roman and Chris Duffy of Nickelodeon Magazine, SpongeBob Comics, put together an awards ceremony for to recognize people in comics who are making comics for kids. And one of the guys who is nominated, and I'm not saying vote for him, I'm just saying this is an opportunity to check out the works of a lot of worthy artists who are making comics for young people. But G-Man by Chris Giarrusso is this amazing thing where it's rip-roaring, colorful, bombastic superheroes that I love as a grown-up, but it's totally made for kids. And it does all the things that superheroes does right, where it's like, it's unironically crazy. Like there's this team of superheroes and led by Captain Thunderman. And it's not like a Family Guy joke where it's like, oh, well, I'm going to go, Thunderman's going to sit on the thunder bucket and make a thunder, you know, whatever. No, it's just like, why wouldn't you have a superhero called Captain Thunderman, you know? I mean, in the Hero Code, you have a guy called Optiman, like optimized man kind of thing. But it's about two brothers, and one of them finds a piece of magic cloth that allows him to fly, and then his older brother, who's kind of like a jerk sometimes, stole a piece of the cloth, turned into a belt so he can fly. And it's all about them getting involved in this world of superheroes and, you know, government super agencies and awesome fights and hijinks, but it's all perfectly kids safe, but it's also really thrilling for adults. This book doesn't get enough attention, and I hope that through the awards, the Kids Comics Revolution Awards, we can make more people aware of this amazing series. So this is book three. There's two other books out from Image Comics by Chris Giarrusso, G-Man. And then I'm going to do a self-service.
All right, go for it.
I don't use my own platform to promote myself that often, but I've got a book coming out in September. Called The Warren Commission Report, A Graphic Investigation into the Kennedy Assassination. That is a mouthful. And I'm one of the artists on it. Dan Mishkin wrote it. Ernie Colone illustrated it. And I kind of rode shotgun with Ernie Colone. I did like the layouts of the book, which in this galley you can actually see some of my layouts that I did. You know, I thumbnailed it. And then Ernie and I collaborated on the actual final art of the book. And what it is it's an investigation of the Warren Commission report. So Kennedy was assassinated in 1963, and then the Warren Commission was assembled. Earl Warren and Gerald Ford and a bunch of other guys were assembled to figure out who did it. What happened here? Was it Oswald? Was it somebody else? And this is a visual evaluation of all of the facts and the theories. And I'm not going to tell you what conclusion that the book comes to. But it's also about, like, what was going on at the time. It's also from Dan Mishkin's experience as a 12-year-old when it happened. You know, there's a whole sequence that we do in here where it's about him as a boy finding out the news.
So this is very much in the vein of the 9/11 report that Ernie
Colone did, yeah.
Worked on, and yeah. Is it the same publisher who did?
No, it's a different publisher. Okay. Abrams Comic Arts, who's putting this out. So, but not the most pleasant material to spend a lot of time up close with as a cartoonist, but the book is not gory or gruesome. I mean, there's obviously autopsy scenes in the book, but it's all we framed all the shots so as to avoid the gore.
So you could give this to a 13-year-old and it'd be perfectly
absolutely
fine on it.
Yeah. Absolutely, yeah, yeah. I mean that's one of my personal rules as a cartoonist is I won't do anything over PG-13 anyway. But I will say that there is a page in this book that when I drew it, I got goosebumps. Mm. And I'll leave it to you to buy the book and find
figure out which page it was.
which page was it? But and amazingly, it was a very simple page. It's nothing where I did something really exquisite with the layout and like, oh, I did something that only comics can do. It's just when I read the script, the visuals instantly came to mind, and that's when you know you got a great script, right? But I was penciling it, and I texted Dan. I was like, oh my god, I honestly got goosebumps just now, and that doesn't happen every day when you're making comics. So, all right, so that's all our book recommendations. You got to come to Kids Read Comics this summer to check out episode 100 of Comics Are Great. And thank you, Jamie, for making all the time to hang out with us and talk comics today.
You're welcome. Thank you.
What's the one thing you want people to go to today if they enjoyed your presence on the show?
Ooh, monkeypipestudios.com, where they'll get a flavor of the different books that we've got coming out and everything kind of flows through there. That'd be a good place to go.
Intronauts, when is that coming out?
That is, I have the first 8 pages of art, and it's kind of It's a very freeform story.
Yeah.
So it's taken me a lot longer to get back to it. I've got 20 or so pages scripted, and I'm kind of working on a one shot, a Black Wraith one shot at the moment. Let's put Intronauts to one side. But I'm hoping to get something up on there pretty soon, hopefully.
What I've seen looks really, really cool. But that's, you can go to monkeypipestudios.com to check out the Black Wraith, Department O, Hero Code, Intronauts, Meat Space, Omnitarium, Slate and Ash. Wow, there's a lot of different books on here. What's this one? What's this one? This one is Samurai Billy. Oh, yeah, I've seen this one before. Yeah, this is really cool, too. And then you could also go to jamiegamble.com, right? To because you also do sketch cards, and I actually brought a sketch card that you did for me. It's Jared, the Abominable Snowman with a butterfly. You could actually get, so like Jamie the writer is also Jamie the artist, and he does really cool sketch cards that you can get on his website as well, which we will link to in the show notes. It's jamiegamble.com. That's where you blog too, right?
Yeah, yeah.
So, but yes, we will have to do this again, Jamie, so we can dig deeper into this topic. All right, but then in the meantime, then the only other thing for you, Dave, is just to talk about just promoting the pre-conference.
Yeah, so if that sounded interesting to you, and it should, then and you're going to be in town, then you can please register. So I know you're coming.
For God's sake, register! We don't need 300 people showing up going, where's the coffee? All right. So thank you, Dave, for making time to be on the show.
Thank you, Jersey. I appreciate
picking
it.
This apart with us. So, and thank you to Matt Dubay and Eric Kloster in the control room for, you know, keeping track of all the links that we were talking about and putting together the show notes for me and manning the control boards. And thanks to the Ann Arbor District Library for letting me put on the show every couple weeks. We'll be back in a month for KRC, the kidsreadcomics.org, and you can participate in the show live. Until then, everybody, I have been Jersey Droz of comicsaregreat.com and Jersey on Twitter. Okay, bye.